District 4.
See, you're dating yourself. Man, I was a mere child when he was...
House Committee on Revenue for March 12, 2009 will come to order. We have scheduled a work session on House Bill 2048. Do we have enough? Or should I do the public hearing first?
Well, you could do the work session, Mr. Chair.
We can, okay.
Six, seven, you had seven.
Oh, good. Great, thank you. So we'll open the work session on House Bill 2048. Mazin?
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2048, we've discussed once before on February 3rd. We tried to do it on February 2nd, but we did it February 3rd. And what the House Bill 2048, this is the one, just to refresh your memory, that gives the authority to the Department of Revenue to go into premises, the closed storage room or the closed bathroom and so on. However, we are looking into amendments, and we started at amendment language from the Department of Revenue and people that have looked into it. Your Honor, Sean Miller at that time testified for this. However, it came to our attention that the relating clause of the bill might not work with the language that the amendment deals with.
Mm-hmm.
So, unfortunately, we would have to bring the language of the amendment into a different relating clause bill. So this is not workable as it is. And the Department of Revenue and Sean Miller here, if you want to hear more details about why this relating clause is not working very well into the bill.
Right. So the amendments that would be required take it past examining premises of a person licensed.
Right.
Okay. All right.
And we had, Mr. Chair, we were looking at House Bill 2160 as the one that would get that amendment. However, 2160 is a whole different issue, and we might end up doing that amendment somewhere else.
All right. So this, instead of being a work session, this turned out to be an announcement that we're going to deal with this bill in another bill.
Well, it's a work session in the sense that we've worked it out of existence.
Right. Thank you, Mazin. Does everyone understand the point? We had such a restrictive relating clause in this bill that what we really were trying to get done can't be done in the bill. All right. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2048, and we'll open the information meeting on impact of wine tax on growers. And we have a panel this morning, and I'm very pleased to welcome you, David Edelsheim, Rob Stewart, and Kara, is it Olmo? Please come forward. And you don't need to restrict yourself entirely to impact of the wine tax on growers. If you want to tell us a little bit about the wine industry so we can put it in context, that would be wonderful as well.
Yeah, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
There was a suggestion of free samples to start.
Oh.
Who suggested that?
Not me.
I think, Representative Berger, that the Clerk of the House would have a comment about that, and it wouldn't be a positive.
So would our constituents.
Yes, probably true.
Well, the technical details.
Yes, and it is 8:10 in the morning, after all. Please.
That's details.
Though it's noon someplace in the world.
It is.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm David Adelsheim. I own a winery in Newburgh, Oregon. We started our business in 1972 and are proud to be one of the founding families, if you will, of the wine industry. And I wanted to take a couple of minutes right at the beginning of this to discuss with you how Oregon wine is taxed by the state of Oregon. And I appreciate, Mr. Chair, your questions about the industry as a whole. And if we could maybe start with the taxation question and then round that out with a more broad description of what's happening with the wine industry, that might make some sense.
We would appreciate that.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
So for the record, I'm David Adelsheim of Adelsheim Vineyard. I'm a member of the Oregon Wine Board, which is a semi-independent state agency, the members of which are appointed by the governor. The members of the Oregon Wine Board are also members of a 501c6 organization called the Oregon Wine Growers Association, which is a trade association dues-paying that is the advocacy group for our industry. And I'm here today as a member of that board, the Trade Association Board. And I appreciate this opportunity to brief you on how Oregon wineries and vineyards are taxed by the state of Oregon. I'm joined today by Cara Olmo and by Rob Stewart, each of whom are principals in wineries in two parts of the state, where we will round out the conversation by discussions of what's going on, as I've said. Oregon wineries are really taxed by the state of Oregon in two ways. There's a wine privilege tax that is paid by Oregon wineries, some of them, and by wholesalers on wines that are brought into the state from elsewhere. Oregon wineries uniquely pay a wine grape tonnage tax based on the tons harvested and made into wine. So there are these two components. Oregon doesn't have a retail sales tax, and thus there is no tax at the point of sale, either in a store or in a restaurant. I'm going to talk first about this wine privilege tax piece. Wine privilege tax, which is 67 cents a gallon on wines of 14% alcohol or less, 77 cents on wines that are more than 14%, is incurred by Oregon wineries when they remove the wine from bond, from being held at the winery to going out into the system of sales. Oregon wine wholesalers incur that same tax when they bring wines into the state at the time that the wine arrives. All wines shipped out of state by Oregon wineries are exempt from Oregon's wine privilege tax, but are usually subject to a tax in another state. But like in Oregon, that tax would be paid by the distributor bringing the Oregon wine into that state. In 1977, the Oregon legislature created a small producer exemption to privilege tax to encourage the development of the wine industry in Oregon. This exemption, which is under ORS 473.050 sub 5, applies to wine sold in Oregon and to all domestic wine producers under certain conditions. Wine sold in Oregon and is available to all domestic producers, not just Oregon producers, but producers from anywhere else in the U.S., because, of course, you can't discriminate against wineries in or out of state on a tax provision in the state of Oregon. There are two components of this exemption. If a winery produces less than 100,000 gallons of wine per year, the first 40,000 gallons of wine sold in Oregon are exempt from that tax. Of the 400-something wineries, whatever that means in our state, perhaps only 30 are producing over 100,000 gallons of wine at this point. The second piece is if a winery produces more than 100,000 gallons of wine, it pays privilege tax on all gallons sold in Oregon. A winery that's producing over 100,000 gallons of wine, most of those gallons are going out of state. So it's only on a small portion, that portion sold in Oregon, that a large producer would pay tax to the state of Oregon. But the overall goal of this exemption has been to promote the industry in Oregon and has resulted in the creation of many small wineries in Oregon over the 32 years that it's been in effect. Wine privilege tax is assessed only on wineries that produce larger quantities of wine, and again, only on that portion sold in Oregon. Today, there are about, as I've said, 30 wineries. We don't know because that's actually privileged information. It's not public record, but we believe there are about 30 wineries that pay privilege tax on their sales of wine in Oregon.
These are Oregon wineries.
Oregon wine, yes. And
I assume Gallo pays as well.
They pay a small amount, yes. No, in fact, the vast majority of privilege tax is paid by large wineries out of state, and of course, I misstated that. The winery doesn't pay it if it's out of state. It's the Oregon distributor bringing that wine into the state that pays it. And of course, much of what is brought into the state is from outside the country, and all wine is subject to privilege tax produced outside the U.S. Of the 67 or 77 cents of privilege tax, 2 cents of all wine privilege taxes collected by the state go to the Oregon Wine Board, which, as I've said, is a semi-independent state agency set up in 2001 session, the members of which are appointed by the governor. The Oregon Wine Board directs these funds to pay for research and education, but the amount of money that comes from that is pretty small, and thus it can really only address the most serious issues facing wine grape growers and winemakers. The research priorities that we set, in fact, we went through a process just yesterday of determining which projects that we've received. We go through this process in coordination with a bunch of research organizations in California, and we're hoping to get Washington into that same coordination so that we make the best use of tax dollars to get the most research possible. I'm going to change now to the wine grape tonnage tax, which is the other mechanism that affects Oregon wine growers, grape growers, and wineries. The $25 per ton wine grape tonnage tax is applied to all wine grapes grown in the state of Oregon and is paid by both small and large vintners. Half of the $25 is hypothetically paid by the grower, half of it paid by the winery. The winery is responsible for paying that tax. It's certainly the largest grape tonnage tax or fee levied anywhere in the United States. We believe it's the largest such tax anywhere in the world. The proceeds from this wine grape tonnage tax go to the Oregon Wine Board to pay for industry-directed marketing promotion. These dollars are principally used to market Oregon wine to the entire world. These funds are augmented by federal grants, particularly for export, and the Oregon Wine Board works closely with Travel Oregon to promote tourism and particularly the aspect of tourism that brings tourists to wineries. So the status of taxation of Oregon wine from the industry perspective is a little complex. The Oregon wine industry is continuing to grow, even in these difficult times. There remains continued interest in what we're doing. A good part of this growth is taking place in southern Oregon in the Columbia Gorge and in eastern Oregon in the Walla Walla area on the Oregon side. These regions have incredible futures with varieties other than Pinot Noir, which is commonly associated with the Willamette Valley. In the entire state, almost every winery startup is very small. And Oregon has had the reputation over the last 30 years as the last refuge of the undercapitalized winery. In essence, the state appears to the outside world to be very friendly to startup wineries. And this small winery exemption to privilege tax is an important part of the financial calculation that enables artisan winemakers to operate their small businesses successfully in our state. Wine industry leaders have discussed these two aspects of taxation on ourselves. And we've tried to figure out what would be the most rational way for the state of Oregon to tax us. But to this point, we really don't have consensus within the industry on what makes the most sense. The practical effect, though, of eliminating a small winery tax exclusion in one fell swoop would be to impose a tax burden on small wine producers at a time when they're really fighting for market share, shelf space, and perhaps even their existence in these times. It would deter new entrants and the growth of authentic, artisanal, sustainable winemaking. The reputation, and that's the reputation that Oregon wines have within the state and beyond. So I would like, unless there are questions at this point, I'd like to hand this over to Rob Stewart to talk a little bit about the process of starting a small winery from scratch.
Why don't we find out if there are questions about the taxation as it exists today? I don't see any, so let's go ahead.
Thank you.
Representative Benz, did you have one?
I just had a question about the phrase, when you remove wine from bond, can you tell us non-winery people what that means?
Yes. Thank you for asking.
Mr. Chair, he wasn't just asking for himself. He was kind
of Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this quickly falls into incredibly complex arena of the intersection of federal mechanisms and state mechanisms, but I'll try to make this as simple as I can. When wine is produced, there is the wineries incur an obligation to pay tax, both to the federal government and potentially to the state government. Under the laws of the federal government, the wine is considered to be in bond until that wine is until the tax is paid on that. In other words, we have to take out a bond with a bonding company that is pledged to the federal government to ensure that we pay the tax on the wine that we produced. And so wine can be in two can have one of two statuses. It can either be in bond, that is, not yet having paid the tax, typically at the winery, or it can be tax paid, sometimes at the winery, sometimes at another warehouse, or in your home, or wherever. For the OLCC and by Oregon law, wine is not considered produced until it is removed from... That's not true. It is not... I can't explain it in a different way. As long as it is held without having incurred... without having had the tax on it paid, it is in this status called in bond. And it's a legal status. It's not... It doesn't really relate to whether it's still in a tank or in a bottle. It's simply a mechanism to determine the point at which tax is due. Is that about as clear as mud?
That's perfectly adequate for the moment. I have a follow-up.
please, go ahead.
I apologize.
You can make an estimate. What's the federal tax per gallon?
The federal system has a similar small producer credit, but instead of it being a single line, small wineries are exempt to a point and then pay increasing amounts of tax after that point. Interestingly, the same person who introduced that the small producer tax credit here in 1977, went on to work for a national lobbying organization called Wine America and introduced the same thing into the federal government, but learned from this point at which it's either all or nothing in Oregon and made it a gradual one for the federal government. Most of us in Oregon pay 17 cents a gallon, but once you get fully instated up here, it's 99 cents a gallon.
Thank you.
So to follow up on Representative Bent's question, it sounds to me, from what you've said, as though wine that's actually fermenting in the vat or curing in a bottle, if it's a bottle of sparkling wine, is in bond. You're not ready to move it out of the winery or sell it. Other wine might also be in bond, and that might be wine that you are storing in the bottle, but because you don't think it's ready for sale yet.
Mr. Chair, that's absolutely correct. A wine cannot be tax paid until it is in a finished package, i.e. bottle, label, all that. The ready for sale part is always a little questionable, but you certainly would not pay tax on a wine until at least it was ready, theoretically ready for sale. Whether it's whether you've decided to sell it or not yet is a different question somewhat. But you could not pay tax on wine that was not yet bottled.
Right. You produce wine that doesn't reach market for a number of years after the vintage. Some of the wines that you produce. I assume that at some point between the time the wine is initially made and the time you decide to sell it is when you pay the tax and it goes out of bond.
Mr. Chair, yes, absolutely true. And the most typical time to pay the tax is when the wine leaves the winery. You could choose to pay it before at the time you bottle it, but most people choose to hold off making the payment on the wine until they have to. But sometimes there are choices that are based on convenience, and you may decide that you want to do it all at one time. The confusion often becomes, much of Oregon wine is stored in warehouses off-site. It's quite expensive to build a warehouse to store wine at the right temperature. And in the years since 1977, a number of businesses have started up whose sole purpose is to store wine for people, wine that's not yet ready for sale, or at least has not yet been sold. But typically, people would pay tax on the wine when it leaves the winery, whether it's going out of state or to a warehouse.
Thank you. Representative Pence?
Mr. Chair, thank you. And just a very rough estimate, how many gallons of wine to a ton of grapes?
Gallons of wine to a ton is about 165.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's go ahead with the other piece. I have some other questions, but I suspect they relate to the other part of what you want to talk about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rob Stewart has our Stewart Winery in McMinnville.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for having me here. I wanted to sort of tell you a little bit about...
One of our customs is that each person who testifies identifies himself.
I'm sorry.
So even though you've been introduced, you need to do that again.
I apologize.
No, that's fine.
Rob Stewart from our Stewart & Co. in McMinnville, Oregon.
Thank you.
I came to Oregon in 1980, attracted by the few elder statesmen of our industry, people like David Adelsheim and Dick Erath and Susan Sokolwasser. There were a handful of them, and I was very attracted to this wine industry. I have a degree in biochemistry. I grew up in New York in the public system. And I dreamed of having a winery someday. 22 years after that, so in 2002, after working for many people, I think my first job was at Valley View in Southern Oregon, and I was making $4.50 an hour, and I was ecstatic. I dreamed someday of having my own winery. So 29 years later, here we are, and I do have my own winery. What it took was a lot of time and a lot of hard work and ultimately my reputation to convince somebody to loan me a little more than $2 million to do this. That being said, I love to tell people I'm a millionaire. I owe at least $1 million. And so here I am facing this debt, but I'm used to that now. And I support, there are three other families that work for us, or three other members of families that work for us, and then my wife and I, because we're not considered employees, because we're members of an LLC, but we are also employed, we pay health insurance for these people, and you know, I work on an average of 60 hours a week most of the time, and then during harvest, more like 100 and plus. But I love what I do. And this taxation issue has small exemption tax has allowed me to get to this point. It's a small piece, yes, but it's a part of the piece that has allowed me to get to a point where we produce about 20,000 cases a year. That's a little over 57,000 gallons of wine, and that's pretty much my story. It's brief, but thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
Can I ask what varieties you're producing and what label?
The varieties we produce are predominantly Pinot Noir, Pinot Gris, and a small amount of sparkling wine. We will come out with we cannot call it a port, but a fortified wine after 9 years of this project in 2010. And
label?
I'm sorry, the label, we actually have two labels. Big Fire is our everyday label, and that's a two-pint Guinness story as to how we came up with the name. And our Stewart & Co.
yes.
And our Stewart & Co. is our reserve label.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please.
Mr. Chair and members of the Revenue Committee, my name is Cara Olmo, and I own Wooldridge Creek Winery in the Applegate Valley of Southern Oregon. My story is somewhat similar to Rob's and similar to David's, only just started happening 6 years ago now. I was graduating from Fresno State in California. I have a background in the California wine industry. I received a degree in enology from Fresno State, and together with my now husband, we went out on a search looking for a place to start a small family winery. We have three small children. We were looking for a place to farm and be able to grow a farm product, sell direct to the public, and have a small family business that would flourish and be passed along to our children and potentially their grandchildren. We came to Southern Oregon to grow many different varietals. The Oregon wine industry has a world-class reputation for Pinot Noir. The North Willamette has grown that reputation and created a platform that we can grow other parts of our state based from. The Eastern Oregon region and Southern Oregon may not be the best producing regions for Pinot Noir in the world, but they're proving to be exciting places for Zinfandel, Tempranillo, Malbec, Syrah, Viognier, Chardonnay, Riesling, Gewürztraminer, and now Petite Syrah as well. And I have every single one of those, including a little bit of Pinot Noir, on a 50-acre farm that we're currently farming in Southern Oregon. The spirit of the Oregon wine industry is different. We chose to leave California in an industry that I was extremely vested in and really admire because we were looking for something small. We were looking for somewhere where we could still make a difference and we could participate both with our neighbors and making wine and growing grapes and doing research, but also have a voice here in Salem and talk to our legislature about creating an environment in which we can farm and grow our vineyard acres, sell to tourists coming to our area and our local communities. And it's working. And the small vintner's exemption is a very small component of the equation, but it is a component of it. The tax burden on small family wineries, it's large not only in its financial burden, but also in the administrative burden that it poses. We don't have bookkeepers. We don't have people sitting in the office Monday through Friday waiting for something to do. We have a mom and a dad, a cellar worker, some vineyard workers, a person who manages our vineyard in addition to others, a neighbor who helps us with our tasting room, and a person who works on outside sales for us throughout the state of Oregon. There's no one sitting in our office that could take on the administrative burden of keeping an entirely new set of records, paying a new tax potentially on a new system of payments, whether that may or may not conform with the federal timing of our payments that we're making now. And the amount of revenue that we'd be looking at just doesn't, It's not enough. It's not worth placing this burden on this group of individuals. The small vintner's exemption was originally passed over 30 years ago to aid in the development of small family wineries in Oregon, and it's working. As you've heard from some of our founders, David Adelsheim, and even you now, Robert, would be considered kind of in that founding group as we're moving along. The exemptions placed a part on providing an environment where small family wineries can flourish. Their businesses are becoming larger, and some of them are paying into the current tax system now because their businesses have been successful. In southern and eastern Oregon, we're just now on the very beginning of this growth curve. Where you were at 30 years ago, I'd say we're 25 years behind, 27 years behind. Just in the last 5 years, we've seen over 30 wineries start in southern Oregon alone. And these wineries aren't just wineries. They're farms. They're businesses that exist in our state because we're producing a product based on an agricultural commodity that's keeping Oregon's valuable farmland in farming. We create well-paying, stable employment opportunities for our communities, and we participate in every fundraiser I think anyone could ever dream up, from dogs to schools to libraries to arts and entertainment, women's shelters, food banks. The nonprofit organizations in winery owe a great deal to the small vintners in this state. I have a neighbor who makes 500 cases of wine. She's a very good friend, mom. They do everything themselves. They actually do not have one employee. And they donated over 50 cases of wine last year to our local economy. They are invested. They, rather than paying money to the local newspaper for advertising, they're choosing to grow their business based on a model of giving 10% back to the community to aid in the community in which they want their grandchildren to work in. And the small vintner's exemption is a part of this equation for them. Our industry is still young. It feels advanced in some ways when we listen to David and we see the success and we see Oregon wines out on the world stage and we talk about them aging for 20 years. But the vast majority of us are just getting started. And we need this help. We need the involvement of our state to not place an additional burden on the very smallest members of our industry. Adding a new tax to the small wineries in the state of Oregon right now would cause both a financial and an administrative hurdle that would be extremely difficult for us to weather in this time of economic uncertainty. And now is not the time. We certainly want to be a part of the solution for Oregon. We believe in many, many ways we are. But now is not the time to increase the taxes on the smallest farms and wineries in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel? And I think that they may be willing to tell us a little more about their business.
Sure.
If you want, Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, if you indulge me, I'd like to make a little advertisement here.
Okay.
For those of you who don't know about it, in West Salem is the Chemeketa Viticulture Center, which is heavily supported by the wine industry. It is a teaching and training facility in this industry by the community college, and if you get a chance to go out there, I would encourage you to. We often have meetings out there. It's a wonderful setting, and it gives you a flavor of this industry, and they have invested heavily in training and getting good jobs and trained people by way of this facility. So go visit it. It happens to be in my district.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think in the Applegate, you're a water-challenged area. Am I correct in saying or assuming that you're using a drip system in irrigating your vineyards?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bentz, we do use drip irrigation for the majority of our vineyards. Some of our older plantings are non-irrigated. But especially with new plantings going in, drip irrigation and access to water and the availability to water is certainly currently an important equation, and we believe in the future will be extremely important. We do have access to water in a lot of places where high-quality vineyards could be grown, but certainly water is going to be high on the topic of conversation, I suspect, for many of us for the next 20, 30, 50 years.
Yep, please.
Could you share with us the amount of water an acre of grapes normally requires? And if you could put it in acre feet as opposed to gallons, that would be helpful.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bentz, I'm probably not the best person to give that exact number. In our specific vineyard in the Applegate Valley, we don't use any the vineyards on average are about 25 years old. We actually partnered with myself personally when we decided to move to Southern Oregon. My husband and myself found another family that had been farming 56 acres in the Applegate Valley for about 25 years. They'd been selling the fruit up to the North Willamette for the majority of those years, and they were interested in taking the step and becoming a winery and producing on site. And so we partnered with them to create the winery. So the majority of our vineyards are older, and we don't start irrigating until probably the very end of July, at the earliest, sometimes into August. At that, we'll put on just a couple of gallons per plant, and really probably six times in the growing season. So if you look at the water needs of grapevines versus the alfalfa planting right down the hill from me, where they run the sprinklers all day long, the water needs for a vineyard would be much less than a home site. I mean, much less than probably the majority of agricultural commodities. I don't know if there's one that may need less. I'm not sure.
Thank you for that, and thank you, Mr. Chair, for this follow-up. How many tons per acre of grapes do you, on the average, hope to obtain?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bentz, it varies dramatically, and it's one of the things we actually speak in the tasting room to specifically, so I'm glad you asked. Depending on the fertility of the soil, the type of trellising, the varietal planted, and the type of production that the wine, that the grape is going into, we can be anywhere upwards of 8 tons to the acre, a ton equaling about 155, 165 gallons of finished wine. To our highest quality, highest concentration, lowest vigor, grapes usually correlating into the higher priced products being down at a ton per acre. So really, to give you a rough generalization, it can be anywhere from a bottle of wine per plant per year all the way up to 8-9 bottles of wine per plant per year.
Yeah, please go ahead. Yeah, you're asking some great questions.
Yeah, well, this one is probably maybe a little more difficult, but the question is your profit margin or your return on investment.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be interested in knowing, on the average, what sort of hope you hold out for ultimately achieving a profit. And I'm totally unaware of how well or how poorly you do in the wine business. So
and all three of them may want to comment on that.
And it certainly varies dramatically. I'm not an economist. Mr. Chair, Representative Bence, I'm not an economist, and I'm actually not responsible for the financial bottom line of our business, as my checkbook sometimes isn't reflective of the way that we would want to run our business. But that said, I do understand the amount of money that we've invested in this. And so to just speak personally about myself and my situation, we moved here from California. We partnered with existing landowners. My partners, Ted and Mary Warwick, have owned Wooldridge Creek Vineyard for 25 years. They have 53 to 56 acres in commercial production, depending on what they're doing in the vineyard. And it was, at best, a break-even proposition. It was really, really tight every year. Of my partners, Ted was a United Airlines pilot. His pension was underwriting the vineyard. And his wife, Mary Warwick, our partner as well, owns a family business located in White City that was also subsidizing the vineyard. As Ted went into retirement and Mary was looking to retirement, and Ted's pension was reduced dramatically by United Airlines, they were faced with the situation of having a 56-acre vineyard on the 250 acres that they currently owned. And understanding that without the influx of money from other jobs, that this vineyard and the employment that it provides and the stability that it provides for the protection of the agricultural land that it exists on would be in jeopardy. Our site would be highly, highly desirable for development if they were to have decided to try to develop it. It's a beautiful place in the Applegate Valley with views of the valley and to the mountains in the west. And that was not what they wanted to see in their retirement. They wanted to see the land protected and to see the vineyard be able to stay in existence for their children and grandchildren who live up in Lake Oswego today. So when we came to them and created a proposition that we were looking to start a small family winery, didn't have the capital to buy land, plant grapes, build a winery, buy the equipment, make the wine, and wait 3 years to have something to sell. That just wouldn't be in the financial equation. We had to eat, and we have young children. So my husband and myself borrowed $250,000. Ted and Mary put $250,000 into building a barn on the property. We formed the business together. Today we own the business 50-50. We rent the land from Ted and Mary and the building from Ted and Mary. We rent the equipment from Greg and myself. So we each equally put money into the business, and we have products that we sell through the tasting room. Before we even started that, we actually leveraged the relationship of our neighbors, Valley View as well, where you got started 20 years ago. They're extremely good members of our community and have been farming and producing wine in the Applegate Valley for probably almost 30 years, 25 years now. And they allowed us.
The first vintage I'm aware of was 1978, but I'm sure it's older than that.
No, I think that may have been
76.
76
was
so
the first.
30 years, wow. And they allowed us to make wine at their winery. We actually before we even broke ground on the business, we brought some grapes over to Valley View. We produced it all ourselves. We got the wine finished in bottles while we were in the construction phase. So before we opened, we actually had product to the marketplace and positive revenue flow. And today, the winery is doing well enough that we're actually taking the next step of our business, which is the business is actually buying all of the land from Ted and Mary and the equipment from us, so that my family will be owners, landowners as well, so that we'll have some more security going in. So we have a pretty unique situation. 5 years into it, we break even. We show a loss at the end of the year, but you know, on our books, we pay our bills every year, every month. We have a $50,000 credit line. We can work within that parameter. We pay all four members of the ownership almost a living wage, and we employ six people full-time, that have viable employment, stable employment, and health benefits.
Chair, if they're looking for an economist,
yeah, you might cause a dent in the promise, yes. Though. Yeah,
I know somebody that could help.
Do either of the others of you two want to comment on that question,
Mr. Chair and Representative Benz? Just to put a little perspective on Representative Benz's question, there are a lot of models that a winery could follow. You can have a very profitable winery at 3,000 cases. You can have a very profitable winery at 150,000, 200,000 cases. The issue is, in this business, one of knowing that you can sell what you produce and knowing that the value of the wine, the quality of the wine matches the price point that you're trying to hit, and keeping the costs of production from grapes to bottling within the model, because the system can fly out of control very easily, and if we had a little more time, I could tell you how many years it's done that for me. we are now profitable and have been profitable for the last 7 years, but it is totally dependent on correctly being able to predict the future of sales. And the thing that helps us the most in profitability is the 7% of our wine that we sell directly to customers. The other 93% that we sell through the distribution system is where the vast majority of our production goes and where our reputation is built that brings people to our winery, where we sell our most expensive wines at the best margin. I guess if I were asked to look at the at every winery in the state and tell you whether the wine business as a whole is profitable or not, it's probably break even.
Thank you. Please, go ahead.
Have you noticed in this current economic challenging time we're in a drop off in sales?
Oh, that's the question we're all very interested in.
Mr. Chair and Representative Benz, it's a great question. And there's a lot of data that's starting to be accumulated at an industry-wide symposium that took place 2 weeks ago in Eugene. We saw information that's being collected nationally by Nielsen. It doesn't represent all wines. I can tell you that there is a general tendency for people to continue to buy as much wine as they did before the financial crisis, but it is often at a lower price point. And it is often at a wine store to be drunk at home rather than in a restaurant. So there's a bit of movement away from restaurant wine purchases to retail wine purchases and from higher price points to lower price points. That's certainly true in Oregon, just as it is true nationally. The number of restaurants, particularly white tablecloth restaurants that have closed in Oregon, is rather staggering and rather unhappy. And obviously those were places where the most expensive wines being produced by Oregon wineries were being sold. On that rather unhappy summary, I can tell you that in our tasting room for the last 2 months and into March, we're selling more wine this year than we did last year. And we're selling more expensive wine than we did last year. We're selling to more visitors than we did last year, even though each visitor is buying somewhat fewer bottles. Nationally, our distributors are doing slightly better than last year, we're working our butts off to make that happen. We're visiting our distributors, we're visiting their customers, we're helping them set goals, we're helping them ensure that they don't have inventory that isn't turning. It is not a time for coasting, it's a time for hard work. It's hard to generalize it to the entire wine industry, but it's my belief that with hard work, the wine industry will not succumb. I am sure, though, even as I say that, that people who started their business recently envisioning selling all their wines for $60 to $100, but having no real system in place to manage those sales, they may have much more difficulty.
Thank you.
I wanted to point out, Mr. Chair, if I might, after Representative Berger's advertisement for what goes on in West Salem, I wanted to point out that in Representative Gelser's district, at Oregon State University, there is a new Oregon Wine Research Institute set up that was funded in part by the legislature to the tune of $1 million to help underwrite new positions theoretically in the Ag Experiment Station, but specifically devoted to growing grapes and making wine. We're in the process of the piece that the industry is supporting. The industry raised $1 million over 5 years to pay for a director of that institute, and that search is currently underway and has attracted a lot of interest worldwide.
So you've essentially endowed a chair.
We in fact have purposely not endowed a chair.
Okay.
We have put money into the OSU Foundation that can be used for a 2-year rolling commitment to a chair. This person will not be tenured, in fact. It will be if you succeed, you keep the job kind of basis. A much more entrepreneurial base for this institute than has typically been seen in the university system.
And very much like the model that you work with directly.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, that's right. One of the things that you mentioned, unless there are other questions, I have a couple. One of the things that you talked about at the very beginning, I'm trying to get back to the notes that you gave us, had to do with the tonnage tax and the monies that are spent on direct marketing and promotion. Could you spend a couple minutes talking about that issue and how that's going and whether the industry sees that as beneficial or not, that sort of thing?
I'd be happy to. If you would allow me, Mr. Chair, to invite the Executive Director of the Oregon Wine Board, who is here,
sure,
who oversees that, to address that. Ted, would that be? Would you be willing to do that?
Yeah, that would be great. Thank you. Colleagues, as long as we're in the middle of this industry, we might as well get the full picture.
Mm. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Ted Farthing. As David mentioned, I'm the executive director of the Oregon Wine Board, which is a semi-independent state agency in the Oregon Wine Growers Association, as David pointed out, that's our trade group. And I would be on behalf of the OWA, I suppose, right now, speaking to the OWB's initiatives. It's complicated, I know. But anyway, the $25 a ton grape tax, tonnage tax, generates about $1 million a year. And as David mentioned, that's spent predominantly on marketing promotions, and that's my background. We employ roughly 7 employees to manage the marketing and promotion affairs, and the programs we manage really do benefit the state. The biggest one is probably generating tourism. We manage a website that receives over 15,000 unique visitors a month, and we manage media relations, a PR team, where we generate over 200 million reader impressions a year, mostly stories on not only Oregon wine, but on Oregon wine country. And in an effort to bring more people to our tasting rooms, as David mentioned, the most profitable sector of most Oregon winery sales is direct to consumers, mostly coming into their tasting rooms throughout the state and then selling to them often through the mail, through the internet systems, wherever they may live. So, again, 7.5 people, we manage public relations and a lot of tourism promotions and a website, yes, and we also receive over $400,000 a year in market access promotion funds from the USDA, federal grants that does employ people within the state. Over 50 Oregon wineries participate in that export program, predominantly driving sales to Japan and Canada and the United Kingdom.
Japan, Canada, and the United Kingdom. Okay.
Mr. Chair,
not great wine growing regions.
No, by design, the French haven't discovered us quite yet, nor have the Italians. But it represents a small percentage of our sales go overseas. Yet we feel that's very critical in establishing the long term viability of the industry.
And as a piece of you described tourism to Oregon, I assume that generates sales not only at wineries but also for hoteliers and restaurants and transportation, people who run transportation businesses and other things as well.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's exactly right. We commissioned an economic impact study in 2004, which showed that the overall economic impact to the state of Oregon from the grape and wine industry is over $1.4 billion. And again, that was in 2004. It's grown substantially since then. Of that $1.4 billion, at least $100 million, and we think that's a very conservative estimate, at least $100 million tourism revenue generated. Gas stations, car rental facilities, lodging, restaurants, certainly the business that's done in the wineries itself is just a small portion of that. And that's growing. We also understand that's considerably less saturated than it is in more established regions like Sonoma and Napa. So we realize we've got a lot of work to do. It's a wonderful partnership between the Oregon Wine Board and Travel Oregon to do just that, to bring more people into the state, have them stay longer and spend more, and really build small businesses in Oregon.
Mr. Chair, if I could add to that, when we determined that we needed to build a newer winery than the one that we had established in our original home. This was in 1993. We were told that there was no reason to put in a tasting room. We were too far off the highway. Nobody would ever find us. We were 4 miles from Newburgh in the hills. We expanded the winery in 1997. Around 2000, we started having people just showing up at our door, wanting to taste wine. We had a very fine reception. We'd say, go away. It was a great public relations approach, I'm sure. But clearly, this was a stupid approach, and in the early part of this decade, we kind of set up an informal tasting room to at least be able to sell wine to these people and allow them to taste it. Last year, we built a full-fledged tasting room, a destination tasting room, which is part of the reason for the increased number of visitors and the increased sales, because we are now taking advantage of the fact that we have visitors coming from all over the world, literally, to visit Oregon wine country. It's not an incidental visit. It's not a visit on the way to the coast or on the way to a casino. These are people that have flown into Oregon for the singular purpose of visiting Oregon wineries. This has grown to such an extent that Travel Oregon believes that the Oregon wine industry is a principal focus of tourism dollar decisions, and focuses much of their work on culinary and particularly wine country tourism.
Thank you. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to be careful how I frame this question because I'm not sure I gave the small beer crafting people equal opportunity. But perhaps you could share with us your argument of why the wine industry should be favored, if it is, if at all, over the beer industry. What if you were going to try to say that the wine industry is doing a better job for all of Oregon than, let's say, the beer crafters, what's your best argument?
And before you answer the question, let me just add to that that we've been considering lately, and you may have read about it, a bill involving an increase in the taxes on beer. And I think that's part of the context for the question.
Thank you, Chair. Well, my question really is this. When we're creating policy here through tax, we certainly want to do it right. And it would be great to hear from you why, in your position as folks that create wine, you're doing a better job for our entire state than, let's say, those who are creating beer. And use alfalfa as a comparative, but beer is easier because it's a kind of a similar sort of a thing. And also, in that regard, you might comment upon your sales and whether or not you think the sales of wine are reducing the sales of beer or vice versa. I'm just interested in which industry we should be doing our best to promote, maybe both.
Mr. Chair and Representative Benz, I would hate to be in the position of having to say that the Oregon wine industry deserves more favor than people producing beer. Clearly, Oregon has a reputation for both products at this point, particularly craft beers, small brewers. That whole part of what goes on in Oregon is another reason that people want to visit our state, and it's part of the reputation of the state. I don't know that the Oregon wine industry is particularly favored. Yes, there is this exemption for small producers. I think in some respects we are using the $25 a ton piece to pay for work that other industries might come to you and ask for support of. That $25 a ton is a huge amount of money, as we've said, $1 million, far more money than removing the small producer tax exemption would do. Because, in fact, it's based on all production at $25 a ton, not just on what is sold in the state of Oregon. It's a big, big difference. Obviously, the tax on beer is one of the lowest in the country. The tax on wine is kind of in the middle of the pack, upper middle of the pack. Well, no, sort of middle of the pack. I don't know that either industry should be singled out for outrageous special protection. I know our industry believes that we are part of our state, part of our community, and that we want to be good citizens. As Cara indicated, a lot of the taxes that we pay are through an outrageously generous support of charitable organizations throughout the state in a way that far exceeds what a normal business would be doing. So in some respects, I guess I would say that a lot of the aspects of what we do for our state and our community are not seen in the simple picture of just looking at privilege tax. The contribution of that we provide as a tourism attraction, which is unarguable at this point, and the charitable support that we do. And I think the preservation of agricultural land, which is not something that beer does in the same way, the preservation of family farms, having this green border around our cities that is preserved by vineyards is a unique contribution of the wine industry, and one of the things that both helps support land prices in the state and thus contributes to property taxes. I mean, if you look around the state, the counties with prosperous wine industries have the highest land prices and thus pay the highest property taxes. Is that kind of where you were trying to go with this?
Yes, actually, it is, and I thank you for that answer.
Mr. Chair, if I may add to that for a moment, one of the components down in Southern Oregon that I left out of my story is that when we went to borrow our initial loan to start the winery, we received that loan from the Southern Oregon Economic Development Department. They were interested in investing in the wine industry in Southern Oregon, and it's working. They regularly bring out businesses that are interested in relocating to Oregon, specifically Southern Oregon, to our facility and to the Applegate Valley in general, to promote that there's wine country in the surrounding area where they're trying to attract the new business to, being the commercial areas of Medford and Grants Pass, but that the livability aspect of drawing their employees and new employees to the facility is higher because of the winery, the proximity to wine country and local artisan crafted products. Thank you.
If I might indulge one other piece of that, Mr. Chair and Representative Bence. We're in Newburgh. Newburgh was a dry city until the 1960s. It is the home of George Fox University, a Quaker university, the oldest Quaker university west of the Rockies. It had had a dominant effect on the town of Newburgh. Until the 1960s, until 2 years ago, it had a pledge that was required not only of all students but of all faculty to not drink alcohol. This is not necessarily something that all Quakers believe in, but it was a choice of Quakers associated in Newburgh and with George Fox. It's an indication of how important the wine industry is in our region that the previous president of George Fox worked extremely hard to remove that pledge so that those who were legally able to drink alcohol, those over 21, could do so if they chose. And this was a big deal for them. It hugely divided their board of directors, but ultimately there were two arguments. One, they needed to be able to attract faculty regardless of whether they wanted to be able to drink alcohol or not, and they were in the middle of the wine industry. This year, the new president of the university, when he goes to Japan, is taking wine from our winery, excuse me, when he goes to China, he's taking wine from our winery to give away as gifts. He doesn't drink wine, but he understands the impact of having a product from his neighborhood of such high quality that it makes an impression on his hosts in China.
Representative Gelser.
Could I clarify the change of that pledge? That's the drinking alcohol off campus. It's still a dry. Is it still a dry campus?
It's still a dry campus. Yes.
Yeah. Thank you. Anything else for this panel this morning? I want to say for me personally that I really appreciate this presentation today, the chance to meet the three winemakers here and to learn a little bit more about how the industry is faring. Those of us who are not winemakers, but wine consumers, certainly appreciate the fact that this industry exists in Oregon, and hearing some of the ways in which it is also beneficial economically to Oregon is important. As you very well know, our governor and previous legislatures have worked pretty hard to try to build distinctive industries in the state of Oregon, and it's wonderful to know that that we have such a high-quality industry and that it's continuing to grow. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we thank you very much for your indulgence of your time, which is very precious. We don't admire the position that you're in this session. We wish you... We give you our best wishes for doing the right things for Oregon. We know you're in a very difficult position. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Anything else this morning? All right. With that, we'll close the information hearing and adjourn the committee.
Thank you. We already worked on this.